Okay, the talk will be about 50 minutes. It's quite a long talk because I've got quite a lot of examples that I want to show. It won't sort of mean very much without the examples. So maybe we can just turn, can we just turn the lights out? Would that be all right with everybody? Because when I show the examples, they just look a lot better. And even that looks a lot better, doesn't it? So my focus is words and music relationships in new media writing. And as Anthony said, this is part of a larger project where I've been working on words and music relationships in a number of different contemporary spheres. I was particularly interested, though, in looking at the relationship between words and sound in new media writing, not only because new media writing is a passion of mine, but because it's a field that's been very neglected by critics. There have been one or two interventions, most notably by Dini Grigar, who I've referenced at the bottom there, but as you can see, that's 2006. It's a very, very short paper. It doesn't really go into anything. It's just really a call to arms, telling people they should be more interested in sound and new media writing. The critics have tended to be much more interested in the relationship between word and image. And word-sound relationships have also tended to be less explored by the new media writing practitioners themselves. If you look at the electronic literature collections, one and two, which are sort of canonical works in this field, you'll see that they all have image. Every single piece has image. But many, many of them don't have sound. And many of them, where they do have sound, the sound is very rudimentary. So this talk, I would say, is kind of aspirational as well as analytic. And by that, I mean that it's about what I think people could do and would be interesting to do, as well as what they are actually doing. I think it's interesting in literary studies how we're always analysing pre-existent works. We're always looking at what people have done. But when you're a creative writer, you're constantly interested in what people haven't done, as well as what they have done, and what the gaps are, and what you could do, which will be a little bit different. So I think it's interesting to bring those two different dynamics together, and that's what I hope to do in this. Am I right in thinking that some people here just need a very brief introduction to new media writing, or does everybody feel they know what new media writing is? Everybody? Yes? Anybody who feels they need a bit of an introduction? Okay, well, I'll just spend a couple of minutes. I'll just spend a couple of minutes on this. New media writing, sometimes known as electronic literature, digital writing, networked and programmable writing, is a form of literature that exploits the possibilities of new technologies to evolve the way we write and read literature. So it uses computer coding and computer programs way beyond the possibilities of word processing. It usually has screen words. It may have also have spoken words. And so for the purposes of this talk, the unit is the screen rather than the page. I think that's the main thing. And I'll just briefly outline some of the chief features, because they will come up in the talk. They are kineticism. That is the ability to move letters, words, and blocks of text round the screen, which is obviously something that you can't do on the page. You can't make it mobile. Obviously, you can space things out on the page. Interactivity. Obviously, reading is always an interactive process, but you can do things like clicking on links, opening up new pages in the work, dragging text around the screen, or things like being asked to co-author the text a little bit, put your own text in with the text. There's processing of text. You can process text in almost any way that you want. For instance, you can turn words into a text image, and then you can expand it, contract it, overlay the blocks of text, or you can do things like systematically substituting letters. So an E would become an I, or an A would become an O on a systematic basis. Lots and lots of things you can do. Textual variability, that's absolutely fundamental to new media writing. In most cases, you're never looking at exactly the same text twice. Sometimes the texts are in a slightly different order, or texts are revealed on another reading that didn't come out in the first reading. So it's a very kind of mobile, unstable textuality. But for any one work, most of the texts would have a kind of family resemblance to each other. You would sort of be able to tell you were in the same work. Examples of these things will be coming up. And then multimedia, which is, of course, the characteristic which is most fundamental to this talk, the relationship of word, image, and sound is absolutely fundamental to new media writing. And sometimes the text actually appears as text image, or image text, as W.J.T. Mitchell calls it. So it's a kind of made very visual. Okay, so I'm just going to play you a 1 minute sample now. This is from Film of Sound, which was actually played in its entirety in Will Lewis's seminar last year. I'm just going to play you a minute of it. As well as just looking at the screen words, maybe you can also just listen to the music. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that in detail now, but I'll be referring back to it. So we come here to the sort of meat of my argument. And my argument begins with crossovers of words and music in new media writing can create hybrid structures which produce emergent meanings. And what I mean by that is if you take word and music and put them together, you're going to get more than the sum of the parts. You may well get something which is not really intrinsic in either the words or the music, but emerges when you put them together, something unpredictable. But I want to argue more than that. I want to argue that these hybrid structures can facilitate various forms of cultural crossing and cross-cultural encounter. And I want to conceptualize this process of formal and cultural crossing as musico-literary miscegenation. Miscegenation being sexual interracial relationships. So I'm using that word as a metaphor here. And of course, I'll be unpacking this argument as I go through. To this end, I've constructed a model. And the basic idea of this model is that you've got the more formal processes down this end flowing into the musico-literary miscegenated space. And here you've got the more cultural processes. So we start off here with the basic elements, word, sound, and image. And we're concentrating particularly here on word and sound and their conjunctions. These conjunctions between word and sound are the intermediate processes, which I'll be talking you through. And those become the intermediate hybrid space, which flows into the musico-literary miscegenated space. At this point, sorry about ethnicity there. this is various forms of social construction, nation state, ethnicity, culture, which I realize is a very broad category. And this is various forms of crossing, cultural crossing, transnationalism, cross-cultural encounter, cultural borrowings and appropriations and translation. I realize that's a huge category with a lot of very different things in it. That comes into the intracultural hybrid space, which mirrors the intermediate space, and they both flow into the musico-literary miscegenated space. So I'll be unpacking that as the talk progresses. So I want to talk first more about the kind of formal aspect of the model. That's the left-hand side of it. And this builds on theories of musical multimedia and work in the area of musico-literary discourse. The work of Nick Cook, Lawrence Kramer, Lawrence Zbykowski are all stars in this field. I was particularly influenced by Zbykowski, who draws on ideas about conceptual blending from cognitive linguistics. And they use conceptual blending to talk about metaphor, actually. And he maps them, those ideas, onto the way words and music interrelate. I won't go into it all, but the idea is that you have input spaces and elements of those come together into the blended space. And it's a way of analysing those elements and how they come together. But I have a lot of differences from Zbykowski. He kind of triggered me to think of things in this way. But I, first of all, don't want to be kind of bedded down in conceptual blending. It seemed rather limiting to me. Looking at multimedia, not song and opera. I'm interested not so much in blends, but in juxtapositions and frictions and hybrids. And I'm also Zbykowski has no cultural framework. So it's just a way of thinking about the formal relationships for him. It did sort of make me think, though, although I didn't want to go into use the idea of blending. I sort of thought, well, from conceptual blending to cultural blending, and then that kind of triggered other ideas. So I want to go back now just to the basic elements. that I showed at the top hand, left-hand corner of my diagram, my model, and talk a little bit about sounds in new media writing and what kinds of sounds are used. The vast majority of sounds in new media writing are what Eric Clark, who's a wonderful music psychologist, I'd highly recommend this book, Ways of Listening, he calls ecological sounds. So they're sounds taken from or mimicking the environment, or they're sounds taken from everyday life. And, you know, it stands to reason that writers, new media writers, would be interested in sounds from this point of view because the sounds have a kind of iconic or illustrative connection with the text. And I'll just play you a brief example of this, very brief example, but you'll soon see what I'm getting at. This piece is actually set in partly in Ethiopia. It's by M.D. Coverley, who's an American new media artist. These things are all recordings, screen recordings by me of particular pieces. I didn't want to be faffing around with the internet and just wanted to say it recorded me there interacting with the piece. So you can see there that she's got the sounds of the flies. They're synthesized sounds. They're not real flies, as far as I know. But she's sort of, it's a kind of illustrative use of the sound. But other people use musical sounds often more for their effective, emotional, atmospheric or immersive properties. If you get a whole lot of people actually sitting in a dark room watching a new media piece, the music can actually be very immersive. The sound can range from acoustic instrumental music, so a piano or a violin or a flute or whatever, to electroacoustic music. And the excerpt that I played you from the beginning, from Film of Sound, our collaboration, you'll have heard that had acoustic piano sounds and also electronic sounds in it, but also some environmental sounds, the thudding of the boots. Well, I call them boots. I don't know if they really are. And the music may be a completely independent piece of music, which is separately composed, and the writer just decides. I mean, obviously, new media writers aren't usually composers, so they just hear a piece of music that they like and they put it together with their work. Or it can be composed especially for the piece. Jason Nelson, who's an American-Australian new media writer, does sometimes compose his own music. It's very, very simple, but he does. And it can include algorithmically generated music as well, music which uses computer programs to generate music. And there are some people who are doing interesting things in that sphere. There can also be voice sounds. This is a fascinating field, but it's not one I'm going to talk about today. The sounds can be straight or technologically manipulated. You can do anything with the voice, change the pitch, change the rhythm, change the timbre, or they can be computer synthesized voices. But that is really a paper in itself, one maybe that I'll give next year. So I want to now move on to the intermediate processes, the word sound juxtapositions, and the way in which they form the intermedia hybrid space. And I'll give some examples. I won't give an example for everything. I've got six different categories here. The first one is coordination, and we've already really covered that with the ecological sounds from M.D. Coverley's After Image. But I think that's a quite simplistic kind of associative linking. You're going to get more emergence, more unpredictability when the associations are multiple and indirect. So if you have words about wind and you have wind sound, it's fairly sort of obvious. But if you have words about wind and you have sound of somebody slamming a door, and then you have later on some words which might relate to that, and you do that over and over again, you're going to get a really very complex network of associations arising. The next category is parallelism, where the music and screen text run continuously together but are independent entities. This is a bit like the work of Merce Cunningham and John Cage. You know, John Cage used to go and write his music, and Merce Cunningham used to go and write the dance score, and the first time the two things came together was on the first night of the performance. And yet when you watch the pieces, there are often many different points of coordination, or seem to be. The text or music or both may be algorithmically organized to be different each time the piece is played, so there may be many different points of coordination, maybe different points of coordination each time, sorry. Now, I want to show you an example. This is a piece called Suicide in an Airplane, and it's a very recent piece by one of the, you know, quite a big star of the new media writing field, Brian Kim Stephans, who's an Asian-American writer. The music's written in Flash, and the music is actually from a piece by a futurist composer, and it was written in 1919. So this, you know, it's nearly 100 years before. The source text for the words is an article from the New York Times, and it's about American combat operations in Afghanistan. I think it's just a bit of quite straight reporting. And the algorithms for the text choose different words each time from the source text. So each time you look at the piece, it will be different, and there will be it will be pulling different words and also conducting various different operations on them. So again, although the music is the same each time, there will be different points of coordination between the words and music. Now, I think this is a very interesting combination. You've got, I'm going to play it for you in a minute. It's very energetic music. It's a kind of futurist celebration of mechanization, engines and flight. And of course, the futurists were also did, you know, celebrate war, some of them. And this, but the text can be read as a critique of the bombings in Afghanistan. So there's a kind of interesting example of how this parallelism between the words and music can bring out both similarities and differences between them. Anyhow, without more ado, I'll just play you a little bit of this piece. I'm not going to play a lot of each example because I just haven't got the time to do that, but it'll give you a bit of an idea. Okay. So two more of these kinds of conjunctions. Interactive variability, where the user can interact with and vary the sound, or the performer can interact with the sound during real-time performance. Again, creating constantly changing relationships between text and sound. And algorithmic synesthesia, this was a term conducted by Roger Dean, to talk about when the words and the music may be composed using the same algorithmic basis for both. So the algorithms from the words can be translated into algorithms for the sound. So there's a very close connection between the two, although you might not necessarily be able to hear it. I'm going to play you an example from one of our collaborations, which shows both these things. This it's possible for Roger to interact with this in performance, but it's also the algorithms for the sound come from the text image. So I'll just play this again as a short example, but I'll just play this for you. This piece from Sound Effects, the text was by me and Anne Brewster, and Roger did the sound and the coding. But the bit I'm going to show you is not terribly semantic. It does show the kind of text processing that I was talking about earlier, so it's interesting from that point of view too, I think. Oh, just a moment. Sorry. Right, sorry about that. Right. So two conjunctions left here, two perhaps of the most interesting ones. One is heterogeneity, where the sound and the text are composed of multiple heterogeneous and dynamic elements which couple and uncouple in different ways. Now, the extract that I played you right at the beginning from Film of Sound, when you see that whole piece as a whole, when you see the piece as a whole, each element in it is very heterogeneous. So the music consists of environmental sounds, voiced sounds, electronic sounds, acoustic sounds. It's also got has speakers round the space, so you get spatialized sound. The text is poetry, narrative, found text, text which is sort of degraded in various ways. The images are taken from all sorts of different sources. And then you get this kind of constant coupling of the elements and falling apart and coming together in other combinations. It's quite abstract, but I think there is quite a lot of emergence in it. And finally, of these conjunctions is semiotic and perceptual exchange. This is something which has interested me for a long time, though. I used to just refer to it as a semiotic exchange. And that's the way different media seem to take on each other's characteristics when you put them side by side. So when we... Although we think of words as being very highly referential and music as being somewhat more abstracted, when words and sounds are juxtaposed, you become more aware of the abstracted nature, the abstracted aspect of the words, and more aware of the referential aspects of the sound. But I've realised over a period of time that this isn't just a semiotic thing, it's a question of perception, it's the way we perceive it. Now, some artists actually play on this idea of semiotic and perceptual exchange, though they wouldn't call it that. And I want to show you a brief example of this. Hanging up. And this is going to actually segue quite nicely into my talking a little bit more about the cultural aspect of my model. So this is Yonghai Chang Heavy Industries Nippon. I'm just going to play a little bit of it, and it's Thelonious Monk Quartet. I'm just going to show, but you'll get the hang of what's going on here. It goes on and on and on, although I like the general idea of the piece, and it sort of fits well with my ideas. It's it does go on and on and on, rather. And I didn't tell you it's sort of about prostitution, or it's or what Jessica Pressman calls a brothel bar. But why I wanted to show it here is it's a quite conscious use of semiotic and perceptual exchange. The movement of the language is programmed to respond to the rhythm of the music. And it's very clever, actually, because after the opening, the Japanese is moving with the piano and the saxophone is moving with the English. And I do have to tell you here that Jessica Pressman, who is a leading critic in this, and is very, very good, actually, she does an analysis of this piece. And she talks about the trumpet rather than the saxophone. This is a book published by Oxford University Press. It's a bit like saying, you know, Midsummer Night's Dreams by Marlowe or something like that. but anyway, she's very, very good, but she obviously has a limited knowledge of music. So here, the word music exchange is not only creating a semiotic dialect, it's also creating a sort of cultural interaction with the language, which I think is really interesting. So now I want to move a little bit more into... Oh, it's funny, you know, Ben, this isn't working now. But I'll just do it from here. I'll just go back to the model, and you can see we're going to just concentrate a little bit more on the right-hand side now. So my argument was that mixings, crossings of words and sound can and may facilitate various forms of cultural crossing. And so I was thinking of things like crossing of national boundaries, transnationalism, crossing over of different ethnicities and ethnic cultures, various forms of cultural encounter, Western, non-Western cultures, but not, maybe not always, Western, non-Western encounters. And various forms of cultural appropriation, so maybe a European or Australian using elements of African or Indian culture. And I realise that that's very broad and also covers a plethora of different kind of power relationships, but let's just soldier on. I think I'll have to stand over here. okay, so my argument was that this results in what I call musico-literary miscegenation. And what I'm trying to do here is reactivate the word miscegenation more positively in the way that people have reactivated the word queer, for instance, which in my youth was a very, very pejorative way of talking about somebody who's homosexual. And I think that what's really been pejorative in the States is the idea of the anti-miscegenation laws rather than miscegenation itself. Why I like this term is that I think it's a bit provocative. It maps the ethnic, erotic, and reproductive onto the mixing of words and music. And perhaps even more saliently, it brings the histories of colonialism, cultural imperialism, and unequal power relationships to bear on our thinking about the word-sound relationship. Now, this has all sorts of ramifications, of course, because the history of classical music is very tied in with the history of colonialism and so on. But it's also very relevant in terms of intermedia and multimedia work, the kind of work that I'm looking at, where word and music relationships are really most successful when they are non-hierarchical, when they are on an equal footing. Because in some forms, like in some songs or in some opera, the words are actually very overwhelmed by the music. I just wanted to go a little bit into the intellectual background here and what I was building on, just very blandly. I didn't want to bore everybody witless with all the intellectual background, but you know, I've been done a lot of reading around globalization, cosmopolitanism, particularly the work of George Ritzer, who talks about the positive and negative aspects of globalization, theories of biraciality, cross-cultural encounter and hybridity. Of course, Paul Gilroy is a sort of obvious person because he's so interested in music. Also the work of Jackie Lowe and Helen Gilbert. Some people here probably know Jackie Lowe. They did a very good kind of topography of cross-cultural theatre practice, which I found very useful. I've also been interested that I'm certainly not the only person who's interested in the positive retrieval of the idea of miscegenation. And Brian Kim Stephans, whose piece I played for you before, is a good example of this. He, in his critical work, he uses miscegenation a lot, but he also has brought out a new book of poetry at the bottom of my references there, Viva Miscegenation, New Writing. And I have worked myself quite a bit with the idea of a post-human cosmopolitanism, and I was drawing on some of those ideas in this too. So now I want to show you and this is the sort of last quarter of my talk, three examples which show different forms of cultural crossing. The first one, I think, is a good example of cross-cultural encounter. The second is perhaps more about transnationalism, and the third one perhaps more about cultural appropriation, although these categories, you know, are quite fluid. Okay, so I'm going to show you this. This is another piece by Yung Hai Chang Heavy Industries, and I'll talk a little bit about them in a moment. I'll just show you this first, just 2 minutes of this. Okay, well, I was interested in the Yung Hai Chang Heavy Industries because they're a cross-cultural group based in Seoul. Yung Hai Chang is a Korean artist, and Mark Vogue is an American poet. And they're interesting, I think, not because they're so at the forefront now of new developments with software and so on in new media writing, but because they do have this strong interest in the word-music relationship. Now, formally, you can see that the movement of the text responds to two different rhythmic levels of the music, the regular pulse of the ostinato, the bass, and the rubato effects of the melody. Rubato is about speeding up and slowing down with the melody. So this is an example of semiotic and perceptual exchange. The text is about an imagined devastating attack by North Korea on South Korea. It's precipitated by a preemptive US attack on North Korean nuclear facilities. And it's basically, it's just, you know, everybody's bombing the hell out of everybody else. And it really is a text about East-West antagonisms. But it's juxtaposed with US jazz pianist Bill Evans's Peace, Peace, which is a wonderful classic piece. Bill Evans himself is interestingly culturally situated because he's a white pianist playing jazz, which is basically an indigenous African-American music. But I think goes very well with the text. So thematically, the music is meditative, calm, and reconciliatory, and it's quite opposite to the content of the text. So here, I think the juxtaposition of the different media does speak to the conflict between East and West, and there is a kind of emergent meaning here, which is something to do with whatever the level of aggression between nation states and different cultures, there's always this possibility of peace, exchange, and cooperation. The next example is from John Cayley. I'll just play a bit of this. This goes on pretty sort of endlessly. It never really ends. But I'll just play you a little bit of it, and then I'll talk a little bit about it. Okay, I hope you've got the the hang of that. It's impossible to. I recorded it again. Recording what was going on the screen, and it's impossible to get the sound to. The sound is just very soft, so it's difficult to do much with it. So John Cale is a British new media artist who currently lives in the US, but he's very, very, very interested in cross-cultural things. He's very, he's fluent in Chinese, and he does a lot of work that goes from English to Chinese. Here, the text undergoes what he is really basic to all his pieces, which is transliteral morphing. And that is the building up and substitution of letters within each textual block. So you can see how the text, what he calls surfaces, sinks, and or sometimes floats, where you get the substitution of letters. It moves between English, German, and French, which you could probably see, and it often mixes languages and inhabits, most of the time, a kind of in-between language. The main text that's translated is the famous one from Benjamin. That's not the whole title of the essay, is it? I've only got part of the title of the essay. It's on languages such, and then you probably know, the rest of the... Oh, right, OK. but translation is removal from one language to another through a continuum of transformations. Translation passes through a continuum of transformation, not abstract ideas of identity and similarity. So you can see that the piece is kind of illustrating this particular... It's a kind of self-referential. There is some Proust in there as well, apparently, a bit of Proust, but it's not that present. The music consists of what he calls sung vocabularies, and the words here share the same algorithms as the music. You see the cursor on the left-hand side, which is moving. I think there are two or three cursors, and they're actually scanning the text and responding algorithmically to what's going on in the text. The music is responding all the time and triggering various events. So I like this piece in some respects. I don't actually think the music's that brilliant, but I like it in many ways because it seems to bring forward various points that I'm trying to make about transnationalism. The translation between the media both facilitates and reinforces this kind of translation between languages and emphasises the broader cultural dynamic of transnational but European, of course, crossings and interrelationships. It's interesting that Jacobson has these different categories, doesn't he? Interlinguistic, intralinguistic and intersemiotic for translation, and it seems to illustrate all those different things. Translation within the language, translation between languages and translation between language and different media. And so I think the emergence here is in the endless process of translation between the languages. You don't arrive at a translation and then stop. The process just goes on and on and on. This translation between languages, music and cultures, and this inhabitation all the time of a kind of in-between language. Okay, well, I've just got one more example, which is a little example from a piece, a recent piece of ours called Motions. The piece is about human trafficking and contemporary slavery. And it draws on many different genres, poetry, narrative, documentary, and photography. It's really basically a small interactive multimedia book. So it's different each time you read it. And you would normally be reading it on an iPad or on a computer, and you'd be going at your own pace. Here you'll just see a little screen movie of me interacting with it. You won't be able to read at your own pace. But you can go and look at the piece if you want to see more of it. It juxtaposes text and images with music, and it uses a lot of the processes that I've talked about. Parallelism between the words and music, interactivity, because how you read the text, what you click on, how you scroll will affect how the music, where different sections of the music actually come in. There's an illustrative aspect to it, and there's heterogeneity. There's four sections of music. There's the flight sounds, a sampled Macedonian music, train sounds, and what Roger calls Americanized music. But there's a lot of cross-fertilization of those different sounds. So the American and East European musics are kind of cross-fertilized. Microtones, which are very small tones between very small spaces between tones, are very characteristic of Macedonian music and also asymmetric rhythms. And Roger kind of cross-fertilizes that into the American music. So I'm giving this as an example of a kind of appropriation, transnational appropriation of sounds, the sampling of Macedonian music. But where it's perhaps rather different from the Cayley piece, well, it's different in many ways, but it's using transnational appropriation to evoke other cultures, but also their suppression. So it's bringing out, through human trafficking, which is a fairly heavy-going subject, the darker exploitative side of globalization and cosmopolitanism and transnationalism. So I'm just going to go out of a PowerPoint and just show you 2 or 3 minutes of this. So that's my last example. You could hear the Macedonian music, sampled music coming in there. And I hope that I've got across my point about formal crossings between music and words, music and literature, and how these formal crossings can create various kinds of cultural crossing. And also, I hope I've got across the idea that I'm looking at examples of work, but I'm also interested in what people might do in the future. Thank you very much.